Hello and welcome to NPP, the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Chris Kover. I'm an editor at Netzpolitik, and I'm sitting here with Caroline Sinders, who is a machine learning researcher and artist. And if you can hear a bit of buzz in the background, it is because we are at the Republika conference right now. Hello, Caroline.
Hi.
Thanks for coming to the podcast and talking to us.
So yeah, thank you for having me.
You gave a really interesting talk here on machine learning and bias yesterday, which is part of your research and what you're dealing with. So you're currently a fellow at the Mozilla Foundation and a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, and researching around machine learning and explainability, right?
Yes. I'm looking at this sort of theme right now in AI studies called explainable AI.
Yeah, this is a really big discussion right now that we are also having in the European Union, because an expert group is working on this draft for ethic guidelines for the European Union, and explainability is a really big topic. So why do you think, why is it so important to have explainability in the context of machine learning?
For sure. I think explainability is such a big theme and topic, partially because I think it's kind of clear that artificial intelligence, machine learning, and algorithms are individual topics that are interlinked but hard to understand from like a common sort of perspective, right? Have we reached sort of a data literacy point of what machine learning really is, right? How many people think of artificial intelligence really as synonymous with robots? And with algorithms, how many people really know what an algorithm is versus the fear of what surrounds this idea of an algorithm? I think people hear themes or words like black boxes or discrimination, misinformation, right? Disinformation. And they hear all this tied to like machine learning and algorithms, but that doesn't actually explain what an algorithm does. It's a byproduct of something that can come out of an algorithm being inserted in a product. Mm-hmm. So I think there's such a push right now for explainability. And one of the reasons I'm interested in explainable AI really is because I don't think that there's a common literacy point yet for most people around what artificial intelligence is, what machine learning is, what algorithms are. And really for us to sort of be engaged in like society right now, everyday people need to understand really more clarity what an algorithm is and then what an algorithm does in the products that they're using.
Why do you think it's so important that we get to a level of literacy concerning machine learning?
I really like this metaphor that may not quite work, but it's something when we describe diversity and inclusion in any field. You can't be what you can't see. I don't think you can't, can you engage with or audit or critique something you don't understand, right? Like, can we have, as a society, recommendations holistically from every constituent, every member of society, about algorithms if we don't understand what they do, right? So, like, we can't have tech equity, even, or like tech equity and understanding or tech literacy, if this is a subject that people don't quite get, right? And I think that's what makes it so important. Like, should only certain groups of people be having conversations about how to regulate algorithms, how to understand machine learning or what machine learning does in society? And why should the barrier to joining that group be a deep technical understanding of technology in general, right? I don't think that's not an equitable society. That's not a fair society. So that means that we have to spend a lot of time really thinking about and trying to explain and show this is what algorithms are and this is what they do in our products, so people can feel also comfortable in critiquing them, they can feel comfortable in having an opinion of them, and then have that opinion actually be informed. So that's my sort of impetus behind it. I know a lot of people use the metaphor of like, it's so easy, your mom can do it. But I think like my dad is the technophobe. So I'm like, it should be so clear to understand also with examples on like a big level and a small level. Like how's a daily small, like mm-hmm. in a small benign way affect your life and in a big way affect your life. If I can get like my dad to understand that or my uncle, then that means we can all start having a conversation. They can have an informed opinion about it.
Yeah. It's, I like that you bring up your dad because I think in my context it would be my dad too, who's yeah. the one who would have, if he understands it.
I'm lucky because my mom is, she's not a mathematician, but she had a degree in economics. So she's often explaining like statistics to me. And she used to work as a bank examiner for the U.S. Treasury. So she's like a very, you know, like smart and math minded person. So I've often asked her to say to me how she would explain algorithms to her friends.
And what did she answer?
She says it's just a mathematical equation. She's like, that's all you really need to know. It's like a mathematical equation that's just trying to process like different information. She's like, it's almost like a recipe. And that's what you hear a lot of people say.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just like a cooking recipe. It's basically just it tells you what to do with certain ingredients in what order, how to put them together.
Kind totally. Of
things. And then an explanation I hear a lot.
I've been trying with my mom to also get her to provide daily examples for people, but this is like out of her wheelhouse because she's retired and she's like I don't really know like what Spotify does, you know. She's like does Pandora use algorithms? I'm like, I don't know, probably. No one really talks about Pandora anymore, you know, like that's the music streaming site she uses in the U.S. You know, and I also think it can be hard, an example with like Netflix, like should we care about the Netflix recommendation?
So one of the things that you're suggesting as a sort of very easy step to move towards more literacy or to move to a level where even not particularly tech-savvy people could understand machine learning would be a warning label for products comparable to what we use right now for food. So for food, we have ingredient lists and caloric information, and you suggest that we should have something similar for products that are using machine learning. Why do you think that such a label is needed, and what would such a label say?
Totally. So I think it's important to highlight, like, in products that are using algorithms, data is a big part of that engagement. It's a big part of that relationship. Like, data really does sort of set the tone for what an algorithm is going to do. An algorithm is also trained on data to do a certain thing, right? A certain task. And then data is fed into that product. So like the data is transformed and like comes out of the task, right? It's kind of like if you're making a cake, right? An algorithm would be like the process of how you mix everything, maybe. Data sort of like sets like what the cake will taste like. And that's not a great metaphor, but it's a decent way to think about it. So I think it's really important to have data ingredients, especially in a part of a product where it's using an algorithm. And in my Republica talk, I gave the example of Discover Weekly. And I want to highlight Discover Weekly really specifically.
Which is a Spotify feature, right?
Right.
For non-Spotify users, maybe. Yeah, a Spotify feature that is suggesting music to you based on your... Well, no one really knows what it's based on.
Yeah. Discover Weekly is considered one of the most popular playlists on Spotify, according to Spotify. It is something that people are really excited about every week to get. I like to argue that Discover Weekly is not just a playlist, it's a product inside of Spotify, because it's a product that like engages you in deeper inside of the Spotify ecosystem in the way that like we should view Facebook Messenger as a separate product from like Facebook timeline, right?
Yeah.
They're separate things because those are two individual things that bring you and keep you in the ecosystem. Discover Weekly uses an algorithm to create a playlist for you based off like previous things you've listened to in the previous week. So it's supposed to be like this delightful playlist, maybe with a couple of songs you've like already heard, but a lot of songs you don't know. But after like, I would argue a couple of months of having Discover Weekly, you can sort of tell it takes like kind of a similar tone in a way. Maybe you've been listening to one genre a lot, and that genre will sort of slowly get like replicated inside of there. That's called like reinforcement, right? That's like reinforced learning. Discover Weekly is looking for cues for you to like skip over those songs. And so if you don't, like this reinforcement learning is reinforcing that this is something that you like, that that this is normal for the system. So in my talk, I give this example where in 2015, I went through this really awful breakup with this boy that had like beautiful Disney prince hair. He had hair that made him look like Prince Eric from like The Little Mermaid. Just like long, it's beautiful, so beautiful. And he like so broke my heart, and it was so awful, and I was so sad, and I spent like every day at work just listening to Mumford and Sons. And that's like, first of all, a band I don't think anyone is like proud to listen to. Like, it's not, you know, you're not there being like
Mumford and Sons, if you're listening, which is highly unlikely, don't take this personally probably.
Yeah. They're a pop band that plays banjos, and they sound vaguely like folky. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana, and so we sort of call this kind of general sound of theirs like old timey, because it sounds like music sort of influenced from like the 1930s, but it's played with like a tempo that's very modern. So it sounds like if you took rock music but gave rock musicians banjos. It's like, and the lyrics aren't even that great. I mean, it's just no one is proud of this. And I like, now I just tell everyone about Mumford and Sons. I'm like, okay, so like going through this awful breakup, sometimes you listen to really comforting music that you wouldn't normally listen to. I was listening to Mumford and Sons, and I listened to every song and every album every day, I want to say for 2 months. And that was 4 years ago. And I still get like alt folk pop music recommendations in my Discover Weekly. So I've fucked up my Discover Weekly.
But you don't know in what way specifically, right? Because Spotify doesn't disclose the algorithm
right.
that goes into compiling this playlist.
But it's very, very clear that it is me listening to Mumford & Sons. Because when there's like massive spikes in data or in trends in machine learning, sometimes like the system will like overanalyze or like lean on that trend, right? Like they'll see this massive spike. And if that massive spike is then reinforced, you've trained now incorrectly the algorithm to assume or to like make inferences that that's what it should be looking for. And in this case, I like overly trained my Discover Weekly to give me things that sound like Mumford and Sons.
I think it's pretty hilarious. I'm thinking along the lines of, because we have we talked about the analogy of food. So basically, if you'd have a food recommendation algorithm doing the same for you, it would probably, after a breakup, then request you to, you know,
like
binge
and
ice cream
yeah.
and binge like a liter of ice cream, or recommend like,
totally.
Oh, so because last month you've eaten 3 liters of
yeah.
ice cream,
this month,
is probably your average
yeah.
food. So try this different flavor, not knowing that, you know, maybe that was really a freak incidents due to special circumstances in your life at that point.
That's a perfect analogy. Thank you. That's a great one, right? And so I drew up or mocked up this idea that was published by the Shorenstein Center. It's a center at Harvard focusing on journalism for a big publication they do called Privacy by Design. And so it was a mock-up for data ingredients. And the mock-up is this little eye. So you click on the eye, and maybe it's just like on your Discover Weekly, and maybe it's on different playlists, maybe it appears on recommended songs, and the eye expands into this page, and one half the page is sort of giving you high level information actually about the Discover Weekly algorithm, like how was it trained, when was it trained, how much data were they using, where did that data come from? Did it come from like all Spotify users, or am I using a special like geolocated like North America Spotify Discover Weekly algorithm, right? Is there a different one for China? Is there a different one for Germany? Is there a different one for, you know, the Middle East, right? be explaining that and sort of give a breakdown of just some graphs and statistics about like the data inside of that algorithm and the data set inside of that algorithm. And then the other half of the page shows like here are like the big data cues or like data flags from your own listening that shape your Discover Weekly. And then at the bottom it shows ways like delete this song, forget this song, add these songs or these genres or these playlists to my Discover Weekly training data, like elevate these songs. This idea really comes from a space inside of machine learning called supervised machine learning. It's where a researcher is sort of looking over and helping train the algorithm. Unsupervised machine learning is where you throw a data set at an algorithm and sorts things on its own and kind of makes its own connections. I'm a very big proponent of thinking of ways to translate supervised machine learning into our daily products that use algorithms. So, like,
kind of not making an expert thing, making it something that you put into the hands of the users who can then supervise their own algorithms in a way.
Exactly. So, I do love Discover Weekly. I don't think we should necessarily live in an algorithm desert, right? I think that algorithms are extremely interesting and extremely helpful, and I think that they're really fascinating. And I love my Discover Weekly because I love the idea of like this weird music thing. And generally it works pretty well. But I really don't want to listen to like folk pop anymore. I'm really tired of that genre. And I would really like a new genre recommended to me. And I have some ideas about what that could be because it's my music. And the point I was also trying to make at Republica is also when we talk about algorithmic justice and algorithmic injustice, we often talk about really big things. Like we'll talk about misinformation on Facebook or Cambridge Analytica. And those are topics we need to talk about and investigate and interrogate. And those are topics that need regulation. But I also want to remind people that like algorithms are around us everywhere. And in the case of Spotify, I use my Spotify every day. So why can't I intervene as a consumer in a tool and a product that I use every single day? And a product that is also entertainment, right? Like no one's going to die over Spotify recommending me Mumford & Sons, right? Like, no, I'm not going to, you know, that's annoying. But is it, you know, is it incredibly harmful? I would say the harm in this case is actually more this idea that, or this trend inside of product design that users can't intervene. That is a harm, right? So why can't we have spaces of intervention in product design, especially with algorithms?
I like that you make that example and that you stress how it's also in so many little things that are maybe not, you know, impacting lives in super important ways. I mean, obviously, because we speak a lot about, which is also good that we do talk about that, because obviously when, you know, an algorithm gets to make recommendations about who is considered more of a threat and then gets and is put into prison, whereas other people get paroled, maybe like the system that is functioning in many U.S. states, or who gets funding because maybe their job prospects are better than other people's, stuff like that, then those are obviously highly life-impacting decisions. But algorithms are impacting us or are already around us in so many more benign ways.
Totally.
And the photo sorting, I mean, most people who have iOS on their phones are pretty happy about all the features that are now labeling your photos for you, right? And I'm not sure how many of them know that that is actually also a machine learning feature with facial recognition.
Exactly. And I think this is where... And that's such a great example, and I may actually incorporate that into a talk, because, you know, should we just very lightly in product design, even, like, there are ways we can show that happening without it being a graph or, like, this big thing. Like, it could just be a simple UI element of, like, you know, like, when you're looking at your phone, your camera roll, maybe certain images... have like blue small lines around them, and you can see like these are the images that are being grouped together and sorted by the phone. Maybe when you click on an album for the first time, it shows you like the facial recognition, and then maybe you could go click on the data ingredients of that and see what's going on, and maybe there should be a way to opt in. This is a small side note to say, in the design language world, a lot of design elements have names that sometimes don't actually make sense. So opt in means that nothing is turned on for you. You have to go and select it and opt into it. Opt out is where it's turned on. Yes, by default. And so when you say these things, for example, so like in this case, if the box is already highlighting the images, that means facial recognition is already turned on. You'd have to go select and opt out, right? So, you know, I also want to push us towards the space of like things should be opt in by default. But UI elements shouldn't be so buried that they're difficult to find, though. And it is this tension, which is why people do opt out, because they're like, oh, well, how would someone find this? You know,
I mean, one is how deep is it buried in the design? And the other thing is, I find, which you were also talking about, is what is your basis of information to make that decision, right? If it's just going to be opt in, it's like, here, click this OK button, and then you're opted in. Or, I mean, in a way, to make an informed decision about something like a facial recognition in your camera roll, I would, in an ideal world, probably wish for information to be given. You know, what does that mean? If I enable this feature, I'm also training an algorithm which is not mine, which is then, you know, adding to the knowledge, basically feeding the faces of all my loved ones into the data set that goes into training Apple's algorithms. What might be the risks? What will they do with this data? Stuff like that, which is not the case right now. It's just turned on by default, and it's a useful feature, and a lot of people, including me, are happy to use it, but probably don't really think about the risks and the negative aspects that go into it.
I mean, I think the deeper issues here, and this is outside of a conversation of is facial recognition ethical or not, and lots of researchers have called for just moratoriums on it and like removing the use of it, right? Like in the example we're sort of hypothesizing right now, which is, or sort of picking apart, you know, which is image sorting into groups on your phone. That's fine if Apple is keeping all of your data on the phone. Like that actually is a way less scary option, right? All of a sudden, facial recognition, while it's creepy, is at least more contained. You know your data isn't being used against you. But we don't know that. Like, is the existence of my images feeding back into a deeper system for Apple, right? Mm. Did I consent to that? How did I consent to that, right? And I think that's where it always will get really complicated with machine learning, which is like as big tech companies improve their products, we have to ask, like, were you using my data really without my knowledge? And it's not good enough to say like, oh, it's in the terms of service. Well, no, like, was I inadvertently training your system without consenting to that? I think about that every time when I have to like do a CAPTCHA code. Oh, I'm just training Google's image recognition software. And I'm always mad about it.
And a lot of times you don't have a way to opt out of that because you have to go through the CAPTCHA to get to a certain feature or place
totally.
That you want to. We've talked a lot about like machine learning, deep learning now, but you also use the term artificial intelligence. And I was wondering, how do you feel about the term? Because I know a lot of people who are... basically, they say the more you're actually an expert dealing with these things, the less happy you are about the term artificial intelligence because it's so misleading, because the systems that we're working with right now, or that we're dealing with, aren't intelligent in the sense that most people would assume when we're talking about artificial intelligence. So how, what is your relationship on that term?
I've like gotten into many different delightful and interesting arguments with my friends who are in the field of when are we using machine learning incorrectly or correctly versus using algorithms versus using artificial intelligence. I just think like machine learning or algorithms may actually be the best descriptor. Like if we're going to just refer to this section of technology, but that's still not quite accurate. And that's sort of the issue because artificial intelligence is a form of machine learning that is, you know, just more like holistically engaging in sorting information similar to where our brain makes connections. Machine learning is very similar in that it's often using neural nets, which are looking again at like neural pathways and neural connections, which is still very similar to artificial intelligence, but they are slightly different. It's hard because I think the problem with artificial intelligence is like due to sci-fi and pop culture, it is always assumed to be like a humanoid, a chatbot, or a robot, or anything that like mimics a human presence. It's like seen as human tech personification. And that's not true. Like a chatbot, a lot of chatbot software doesn't use artificial intelligence. It's using like very simple algorithms. It's using like natural language processing APIs. It's really just looking to see almost very literally like what words are following each other. It's not actually like understanding conversation. Like there are people that are hired who are writers that are like conversational designers for things like Siri, like Cortana. Microsoft has hired a bunch of professional writers and poets and screenwriters to like craft Cortana. And this is true of a lot of chatbot companies. They've hired actual writers who are writing the responses you see. Those responses are not some like magical tech neural net, you know, bringing sentences out of the ether into existence. They're like pre-written sentences that a very accomplished and very talented writer wrote. And yeah, so,
and the system, and basically all the system does is kind of calculating the probability of a certain reply making you happy in that context, you know? So but these assistants don't understand what we're saying. I think that is a common misunderstanding.
Like the machine learning in Siri is translating your speech into text so that the system can understand what you've said into a text form and then match the text to a bank of answers. Like that's what that's doing.
Yeah. Which already seems a lot less intelligent if you put it that way, and probably a lot less threatening to a lot of people. And then also puts people in a position, I think, where like you said, a lot of the way we talk about AI right now is a lot of times making it seem like this magical thing that is impossible to understand anyway, even to the people who create it. And that is not something that you could, you know, come up against or interfere with. Whereas if you put it like that and if it explain it as the system that it is, something like, okay, is that useful to me now? Is this something that I would have to have, that I would want to have in place in a certain section of life where it's maybe really making really meaningful decisions, or do we not want to have that? So I think it's an important conversation to have. I was going to ask you about a project that you're working on right now that I'm very interested in. That's called Feminist Dataset. Can you maybe start by saying what is a dataset? Because we were already touching upon that a little bit, but just to get an understanding, like what would a dataset be in the context of machine learning?
Yeah, so a dataset is a repository of information that really trains the algorithm or like sets the tone for it. So like if you have an algorithm supposed to give you any kind of analysis into social media, you would need a lot of social media data. Like you'd need a lot of it across many different cities and countries and across like many days, weeks, months, or years, right? To then have an idea of like, okay, so like if a political event occurs, the like normal reaction should be these things. So we can like plan for like, you know, spikes in behavior, or oh, this would be a good time to like announce, you know, if we're trying to use social media to like plan like election outreach, you know, these are the days we should like launch certain campaigns. Like you can use machine learning to like kind of guess like that. And it's really just a series of predictions.
So you're learning from past data to make better predictions about the future.
Kind of. And machine learning gets used a lot in those applications. Well, you need data, right? That historical data to train the system that you're trying to infer insights from, right? So if I wanted to, like IBM Watson did something where they were coming up with brand new recipes. And so they worked with a bunch of different chefs and used a bunch of recipes and like put them all together. And they were trying to make like new ideas of like fusion cuisine. And so they had a system that like analyzed like flavor combinations, come up with like new sort of fusion recipes based off that. So they needed a lot of recipes, and then they needed someone to go through and say, these flavor combinations don't work. So data, like in this case, the recipes were data, as were the ingredients. And then another layer of data was, what are things that taste good together? And the taste good together is like the training someone did. So feminist data set is a data set of feminist texts that I'm interested in using further in an art project to sort of play around with what a feminist chatbot could be.
Ah, right. So the output would be to have a chatbot that you could have a conversation with, and it would give you feminist answers?
It would just be, like, maybe not even feminist answers. It would just, I'm just interested to see, like, what it would sound like. But also, more importantly, if you're making, like, any kind of, like, text analysis, you need text data to train on. And I was thinking, like, there's so many random data sets. Like, there's the Enron email data set. Any kind of, if you have predictive text on your phone and you're typing in English, most likely at some point some of that predictive text was trained out of the Enron email data set, because it's one of the largest text public data sets you can use. So, like, any kind of predictive texting on our phone or, like, misspelling, a version of the algorithm or of the math at some point that is, like, in your phone was trained on this data set. So there's all these different kind of text data sets, and I was like, well, you know, even though I want to make this strange art project, this could also be useful for other people. This is just another data set that people could use.
How are you collecting the data? Are you scraping certain feminist hashtags, or how does it work?
It's all through community organization. So the framework is, it has to be intersectional data, so it can't be data that it's that is exclusionary to people of color or trans women and men and trans people, and it can't be exclusionary to non-gender binary. So I hold it through workshops, also because I want to use these workshops as a space to sort of teach people about data collection, the ideas of ethical data and machine learning. But I also, I don't want to be the only like person doing this. And so I came up with the idea when I was working at the Wikimedia Foundation, and Wikipedia is run by volunteers and created by volunteers and maintained by volunteers. And I liked that so much as a metaphor, but also I really wonder, and I think if the future of ethical data and machine learning, like if there's a future for it, it has to come from the community and it has to be really open and transparent. So Wikipedia functions really well as a good metaphor and model for that. So that's why it's held through workshops and then people can submit data. I want it to really reflect like a broad community, which is why I hold workshops like in many different cities all over the world.
So two examples that you gave, I think, were basically someone could bring Beyoncé lyrics from the album Lemonade, and also the Cyborg Manifesto, which is a text, an epic text by Donna Haraway, and right. Feed that into it. But what kind of patterns do you think an algorithm would find? Common patterns could an algorithm find in texts, in something that is a song lyric from an artist or a manifesto or a feminist novel, maybe?
So I'm a little less interested in looking at like those patterns, but I mean, it could be, there are so many things, like it could be very interesting to see how often a person's views are of the future that are talked about in relationship to how sex is perceived, like our gender. I think that could be really fascinating. I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot, trying to navigate a lot of like interpersonal things right now. with a partner, and like how much emotional labor really falls to like the femme presenting person in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really tiring, right? And so I've just been thinking a lot about recently like the construct of gender, and I've been reading like a lot of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's work and listening to watching a documentary she was in and this movie she was in. In the movie, the character that's playing Ruth Bader Ginsburg is talking about how like the construct of sex is a cage, and that women are expected to just be happy in it, happy in their role, but it's a cage. And I've been thinking just a lot about that. And so it could be interesting to see how often that idea, either abstractly or objectively, appears in feminist texts.
Recurring themes, sort of. And
because I definitely feel pretty caged right now by my femininity. It does not feel good.
You already mentioned that, but one of the things I was going to ask also is how do you make constraints? Because what you do when someone comes with a feminist text that is also maybe racist or transphobic, like right now in Germany, or in Europe, all over the place, we have a lot of, we see feminism appropriated by the far right a lot, who are using women's rights as a way to basically like make racist propaganda and pretend to be protecting the interests of women, and when they're actually trying to spread hate against people who are not white or immigrants to this country. So how do you deal with stuff like that? Is that something that is basically like you said, there's certain prerequisites? What kind of feminist texts can feed into the data set?
Yeah, so whenever I start off the workshops, I'm always really clear and trying to define what intersectionality is and give examples of what is pro in the data set. And it does get very interesting and difficult when someone's like, can I include menstruation text? And I'm like, you can include menstruation text or, you know, radical works about menstruation as long as it doesn't exclude trans women or rather even trans men.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and I always feel like I understand this a lot, and I think I feel very well prepped for these conversations from having worked so long in online harassment, where people will have a lot of questions about how rigid they perceive a rule to be. And so I've gotten very good at being like, we'll figure it out in real time because this is a rule. So if you have a text in mind, for example, that you think wouldn't fit the parameters of intersectionality, let's look through it together. Or do you want to find what you would think of is the problematic part, and we can discuss it in a group? And I found that framing works really well. I don't really get trolled that often because you'd have to show up to the workshop and like really want
physically to be there.
Yeah. And I'm lucky that I've always partnered with people running workshops. So if something like that did happen, that person could be removed. There was a couple of times people have asked in very good faith about who have been like older feminists, like about second wave feminism and intersectionality and this current wave of feminism that we're in. And that's always been a very interesting conversation. And I think the thing to always highlight and point out is when people submit things, I still have to go through and relook over all the submissions, and I definitely remove things. Like, I've done things where I've had sheets of paper where people can fill out a form about how to submit the data. And I had like two like Silicon Valley tech bros who they were not trying to troll me. They didn't really quite understand feminism. And so they were like, oh, we read this article on like the BBC about like women and like rape in India. Can we submit that? And I was like, sure, maybe, like, okay. And then I like went through, cause they like looked it up on their phone and then like wrote down the URL, and I went and looked it up, and it was like an opinion piece. So it wasn't like a reported piece. It was an opinion piece about like rape and poverty in India. And it was sort of written from the perspective of like, oh, these poor Indian women, someone needs to like intervene. And it was sort of written like implying India was a really backwards country. And I was like, this doesn't really fit the feminist data set because it's not written from like a feminist perspective. And while it's highlighting a feminist issue, it's like not written in a way that has a feminist tone to it. And also, it's...
It was paternalizing.
It was paternalizing, and it was also, like, racist. And I was like, no, so this, like, doesn't fit the framework. But there are... And I found... I went and then looked at myself. I found a bunch of blogs written by feminists, Indian feminists, about rape. And I was like, this would fit, though, because it's, like... It's from the area, their perspective, and it's written in a completely different tone and way.
Yeah.
So that's like the main one that sticks out. For the most part, people really get the parameters, but also if they have a hard time, I always tell them like, there's time in the workshop for us to discuss and work through what we've found. So like, no one's going to get in trouble. I'm not going to get upset. Like, this is just a workshop for us to like try to find things, and we're going to talk about what we find, and not everything we find may be useful, and that's okay. And that's true also with a lot of data collection and data analysis. We may find insights that are not useful or helpful in analyzing Enron emails, for example, and that's okay. Throw that away for now.
Or so we can decide what is actually useful of that and use that and not use the other stuff.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about something that you were also talking about, emotional labor and how identifying as female is usually attached to carrying more of that load or burden. One of the things that I get the impression that a lot of the critique of the bias and the shortcomings of machine learning are coming from mostly women, a lot of times non-white women or queer people, basically the people who are already in a less privileged position and are affected are more vulnerable to these technologies working in bad and discriminatory ways. How do you feel about that? Is it us doing the labor of that actually people who are pretty well paid and sitting in corporate structures developing a lot of these algorithms are just not properly or enough caring about? Like, is it us taking on labor that should have been done by these companies and by the people doing that, developing the algorithms in the first place? I'm always really ambivalent about this because obviously the critique has to be made. I'm ambivalent about us making it.
That's a really good question. I mean, I have like two conflicting answers, and one of them is there are a lot of really talented women, non-gender binary, and people of color researchers in the machine learning world. And I would hesitate to say that a lot of their work comes out of confronting bias just because they face bias, but because it's widely recognized that actually is a problem. I think one of the reasons it seems like there's a lot of women and like marginalized people talking about it, potentially is because it does affect women and marginalized groups more. But I also think it really speaks actually to the diversity of researchers. And I think what we're seeing now, you know, if we'd had this conversation 10 years ago, we would see a lot of white males talking about bias. There's been a lot of push, especially in technology and academia, to have like diversity and to understand like why diversity is important and how it makes universities and research settings healthier. It actually makes them better. Like, there are a lot of studies done that show that like more diverse teams perform at a better and higher rate. I think I would hesitate to say it is just this labor that marginalized groups pick up on, but it is also a labor we see first, right? It's a labor that we would encounter first, you know. And I think anyone that's worked in any job field, but especially tech, will reinforce that who are the people that like rang the alarm first in any event? It's usually people of color, you know. And that's been true with like disinformation and misinformation harassment campaigns. Like women of color were targeted and things that predated Gamergate and things that were like the same kind of tactics we see in like widespread misinformation campaigns now. Women of color have been talking about that since like 2013. So I think like when a system is designed and there's bias or problems within it, or there's pain points, marginalized groups always experience it first. And I don't think we can ever decouple that right now in tech. So it is this burden that like marginalized groups and women will carry of having to always sound the alarm and then having to push forward and making sure that alarm is heard and understood by everyone. And I want to really emphasize that labor for a second. But I also think it's important to highlight that there are so many extremely talented people of color, non-gender binary, and like femme research folks in machine learning who are extremely talented, who are some of the most talented people in that space. And that they are talking about this most likely not because they are just facing it, but because they are talented and they know what they're talking about. And bias is a thing that affects that entire field, right? And then bias is a problem in us building in machine learning. And I think that's why we also see that. Like, we are seeing, like, these are the thought leaders. And it's amazing that the thought leaders are diverse.
Yeah. I think one project that has gotten a lot of visibility and it's really interesting. It was Joy Buolamvini's critique of facial recognition systems.
Totally.
And the Algorithmic Justice League, right? Who's, and I liked how he stressed that, because a lot of people didn't understand, I think, why it's important to critique facial recognition. Isn't it a good thing, you know, when facial recognition wouldn't pick up on your face? Yeah. Wouldn't that be a privilege? But I guess it really depends on the situation, right? In when it's about surveillance that maybe you want to evade from, that might be a positive aspect, but there's a lot of ways that that we will be dependent on facial recognition systems where it is discriminatory and it's going to be a real problem when these systems don't recognize your face.
I mean, I think about that all the time, and that was raised in my talk, and I'm such a big fan of Joy's work, by the way, and she's doing such amazing, groundbreaking work. And there's a slide in my talk that's inspired by that, which is like, yeah, what happens at a border crossing when facial recognition is used? I've crossed so many international borders this past year, and there was a couple times like the system couldn't recognize my face. And I don't know for what reason, but it was like, it was panic inducing of like, what is going to happen to me? Like, am I in trouble? Like, is there some reason that it's not recognizing me? Like, you know, you start to panic. And it could have just been a glitch in the software, right? And that's a terrifying, terrifying thought. Because this is how you're supposed to get from where you've landed to the place that you need to go to. And this electronic fence is in front of you.
Yeah, take another example. In the U.S., a property owner is using it now, facial recognition system, instead of keys, right, for the tenants to get into the house. And most of the tenants are black. Probably with the rates, false positive or problem rates that we know that the technology still has, not the best idea. So, one last question before we let you go. I'm always interested in... what, other than what we just spoke about, is something that you are really interested in right now? Like, what is something, it could be related to what we talked about, could be totally unrelated, something that you are really taking an interest in your work right now?
Oh man, that's so hard, because like my work is pretty much my life right now. I've been doing a lot of research into a new form of dark patterns called trust patterns. So a dark pattern is like a poorly designed, like intentionally designed flow that doesn't show you all the information. So ProPublica just did a bunch of research on dark patterns around TurboTax, which is this software Americans use to file taxes. And there's supposed to be a free version that's hooked up to our tax agency called the IRS. And the free version, like, it's like, it's a very similar to the IRS website. It's supposed to be an easier way to just submit things. TurboTax suppressed all these different ways to find the free version. So they really hid it from when you download TurboTax, where you would have to pay to use TurboTax. They even hid it from like Google search results. So if you're Googling for free TurboTax, it's like impossible to find. So like this dark pattern was a way for them to force people into paying to use their software. I've been looking at ways in which UX and UI design can be weaponized. And so I've been thinking about, well, are there design spaces or things that we can call trust patterns that like elicit trust but are not actually trustworthy?
Yeah, super interesting. Yes. Thank you so much talking to us, Caroline. So if you're interested in Caroline's work, you have a website. You're also quite active on Twitter. Follow her on Twitter. We will include... Or do you want to say your handle?
Oh, yeah, it's just my name. It's Caroline Senders.
And, yeah, also, if you enjoyed this podcast, our work at Netzpolitik is almost entirely funded by donations. So maybe consider supporting us and check out the other articles and other topics that we write about. If you're listening to this podcast somewhere where you can recommend it, we'll be happy to get a good recommendation. And thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.